Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025, and our friends John Helmer and Ray McGoran are back with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get started with the conflict between the United States and Iran and Donald Trump. Donald Trump's shocking comment that he's going to bomb Iran. He's going to put tariffs. He said the same thing about Russia, put tariffs on Russia. But when it comes to Iran and the way that he's trying to deal with Iran, and today we've learned that Donald Trump is considering indirect talks with Iran, and which is totally different from 2 days ago that he said he's going to bomb Iran. What's going on, Ray? Let's get started with you. What's going on, in your opinion, with the Trump administration?
I think the best way to start is to quote Vladimir Putin about a year ago when he was asked, who do you prefer on the other side of the Atlantic? What kind of president would you like? And he said, predictable. That's why I really hope that Joe Biden wins. And then he sort of slunked off and a little smile on his face, okay? And then when Kamala Harris became the heir apparent, so to speak, he was asked again. And he said, oh, yeah, now we're supporting Kamala Harris because Joe Biden said that would be a good idea to do. Yeah, all right, because now the whole thing was predictable, okay? And I think most will agree that Donald Trump is the epitome of unpredictability. He's the icon of not knowing what he's going to say next. So this gives me a lot of hope that he will come to his senses when he's advised that, look, you know, Iran has a deterrent. Iran can do real damage. As a matter of fact, Iran may have missiles. We don't know. They have missiles that can meet, they can reach Dio Garcia. And that could be a real problem for those fancy super bombers you have there. They may be stealth when they get up in the air. Underground, not so much.
John?
I agree with Ray, but let's look at it the way the Russian assessment will be, because for the time being, what's striking about the Russian response to Trump's threats on bombing both the Houthis and Iran is silence. Now this is a telling silence. First, we know that there are six B-2 bombers parked in Diego Garcia capable of launching the kind of so-called stealth bombing raid on Iran. Second, and equally informative, we know that the United States Air Force has been flying Globemasters to deliver unusual amounts of military cargo between Germany and the Al Hudeid base in Qatar, which would be part of any kind of support supply operation if there's a major bombing and missile attack, as well as the kind of fighter interceptions and decoys. All that stuff is happening, and therefore the preparation for a raid on Iran pardon me, is made obvious. Is that a bluff? Is that a Trump bluff? From a point of view of Iran, and therefore the Russian security assessment, which remains silent, the fundamental elements seem to me to be these. First of all, Iran has now the capability within 3 months to enrich its nuclear material to the production of at least 4 nuclear weapons within 3 months. If forced by this combination of maximum threat pressure and total disbelief in the credibility and predictability, as Ray said, of the Trump administration. Second, and this is sort of left out of most of the commentaries, Iran now has mutual assured destruction. It has the capability to deliver hypersonic level speed missiles, which cannot be destroyed in a US or combination Israeli-US bombing attack. Or at least the US and Israel cannot assume any longer that Iran can't launch a devastating attack on Israel. let me go back to 1983 when Saddam Hussein said as much under the threat of Israeli nuclear attack on Iraq. Saddam made a great many mistakes and paid with his life for it. Okay, but what he said, we now know because a document surfaced that the US captured and then published, that he was talking to his generals and a Palestinian leadership. He said, we know that the Israelis have at least this number of nuclear weapons. The text of what Saddam said is in the Jackal's Wedding book that I've written. We know that they have that many nuclear weapons. If they launch them at us, we know how many Iraqis are likely to die, no matter what we try to do to protect them from nuclear blast effects. But we also know we can go on fighting for 2 years. And over 2 years, we can inflict a level of damage which Israel cannot survive. Now, Saddam, who was a great deal weaker and had virtually no Soviet support at the time, certainly he went to war against Iran, one of his fundamental mistakes, against Moscow's advice. We know that Iran is far more capable now of inflicting a level of damage on Israel it cannot survive over 2 years. Therefore, if we know it, if the Russian side knows it, I'm leaving aside the Israeli beating of the chest on in their press and leaving aside Donald Trump's tweeting and beating of the chest in tweet terms, if these things are clear, then it would seem to me the Joint Chiefs must be telling Trump and his merry men, the ones we saw in Signalgate, don't get merry, boys. You cannot inflict a level of damage on these chaps that can save Israel. You will destroy Israel. These are capable of doing that. Therefore, you have to go to negotiation. Therefore, the Iranian terms for negotiation are indirect, and therefore we come back to something like reasonable. Now, what's the Russian position on reasonable? Well, the Russian position on reasonable was set out in August 2021. It's the Russian concept on mutual security in the Persian Gulf. And the concept is very simple. Russia's against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction on all sides. They didn't have to say Israel's got nuclear weapons. That was understood. The Russian position is so long as one side has weapons of mass destruction and the other side is short of them, and one side threatens the other, Israel and the United States threaten Iran existentially, the motive for Iran to develop nuclear weapons, which Russia does not want, it threatens war for the region and it threatens war on Russia's southern border. So long as you have an imbalance, the Russian solution is negotiate a balance, and that's the Russian position. In the meantime, and for the time being, what's remarkable is Foreign Minister Lavrov has said nothing on Iran in weeks. There haven't been the same level of meetings with Iranian officials by Mr. Bogdanov, the deputy foreign minister, or at the Security Council level by Mr. Patrushev. There haven't, everything's silent. That means a lot's going on, and nobody in Moscow wants to tell the world.
Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I would chime in, John, and I would say, yes, that does mean a lot's going on. It's just that the Russians are being very circumspect about it. I imagine there's a lot of loud stuff going back and forth between Putin's close associates like Ushakov or Lavrov, okay, between our merry men, or maybe between Trump himself. What they're saying, in my view, is, Mr. Trump, with all due respect, we have close to a mutual defense treaty with Iran right now. If your merry men have not advised you of the disadvantages on the ground that you, John, just mentioned, not only that, but we don't want it either. And if you're intent on developing a reasonable relationship with us, and you let yourself be sucked in by Israel to attacking Iran, forget about it. That's the end. We're going to go finish Ukraine off all by ourselves. We're not going to let you down easy. And forget about a rapprochement, much less a détente, okay? This, I think, is they recognize as Donald Trump's priority. He's even in a hurry for it, okay? So this back and forth on, on Iran is entirely predictable because he's so unpredictable, and I'm glad to hear the latest is, oh, they're going to have indirect talks or so forth. You know, it boggles the mind, as you say, John, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff would say, all right, well, we'll give it a try. I mean, you know, what's to lose? Well, that's a hell of a lot to lose for Israel, yes, as well as the United States. Now, with respect to uranium enrichment, now, John, I'm not going to compare you to Tony Blinken. That would be an invidious comparison.
But he said
not 3 months, 3 weeks or 2 weeks or, you know, there. But enrichment is the, what do you call it? Where you drag a sardine across a path, okay? It's a diversion, okay? What we're talking about here is working on a nuclear, and I stress, working on a nuclear weapon. Now, sometimes it's good to be as old as I am, or, you know, younger than you, John, but old as you are, all right?
Well,
because you can remember back to 2003, when we invaded Iraq on the false premises that there were nuclear weapons there, or that Saddam Hussein was in some measure responsible for 9/11 because he has very close ties with al-Qaeda. Okay, all of those bald-faced lies, I'm embarrassed to say that I know some of those people that participated in that charade. Okay, well, we know that happened. What happened right after that? Well, Bush and Cheney, on behalf of the neocons and Israel, were prepared to get themselves sucked into a war against Iran. They were beating their breasts saying, real men don't go to Baghdad. Real men go to Tehran, right? Oh, so what happened? Somebody came in, an honest person, a manager of intelligence, and he prepared an estimate which said in November of 2007, okay, that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, had not resumed work on it. That was expressed by all 16 intelligence agencies unanimously and with high confidence. November 2007. What happened? Well, we know what happened. Bush wrote in his memoir, my God, that deprived me of the option of attacking Iran because, quote, how could I possibly explain an attack on the nuclear facilities of Iran when the entire intelligence community says that they have no active nuclear weapons, okay, not uranium enriched weapons program? Bummer. Now, that's the only time in my whole experience, and I know about what happened even before 1963 with respect to these national intelligence estimates, that's the only time I can recall where a national intelligence estimate done by an honest manager and honest troops play a huge role in preventing a war. What do we have now? Well, I was watching really closely to what Tulsi Gabbard, as the new director of national intelligence, would allow into the latest threat assessment, annual threat assessment, 2 weeks ago. What did it say? It said, we reiterate our judgment, as we did in 2007, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, and the supreme leader who issued that edict to stop working on a nuclear weapon, he has not, quote, reauthorized work on a nuclear weapon. So since 2003, up till now, we have no evidence. As a matter of fact, we got the place wired. We would have evidence right away, and they're not working a nuclear weapon. Now, nuclear weapon, what does that mean? Well, that means not 2 or 3 months. That means almost a year by most engineers. If they're not working on that, then they don't have something to put that enriched uranium in and put on a side, on a missile. Okay, so that's really big. And the last thing here is that even Bill Burns, for God's sake, you know, to atone for as many lives, like Putin has already lost in Ukraine, like Putin's running out of missiles and ammunition. To atone for that, a week before he left office, he said, well, you know, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon, and we would know right quick. We would know right quick if they broke that engagement, if they started working on a nuclear weapon. So what I'm saying here is that the situation is very different this time. You had an honest manager do this. Yeah, it was 2007. What's that? 18 years ago. But every year since, and this is big. I mean, there's precious little to defend the intelligence community for in these days, but that's big. So it's another way of saying don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's lots of bathwater. But as long as these analysts are allowed to say what they think on this very crucial matter, then Netanyahu has to go to great lengths to mousetrap Trump into committing suicide for Netanyahu and some real damage to U.S. interests, not only in the region, but elsewhere as well.
John, what's so confusing for the on the part of the Iranian, I would argue even on the part of Russians, is the way that the West is sending messages, mixed messages to the countries, to these two countries. Yesterday, we've learned that the Israeli Channel 14 reported that a large-scale attack on Iran will begin soon, an unprecedented assault since World War II. On the other hand, you hear that Donald Trump is talking about that he's going to bomb Iran. Then he says that he's going to consider indirect talks with Iranians. Why is it so much difficult for the West to understand the position of Iran? We know that, at least we know Iranians are willing to talk, to negotiate. They're not going to negotiate directly under tremendous pressure coming from the West. But you don't see Donald Trump, if he's interested, if he's really concerned about the Iranian nuclear program, you want to negotiate with them, not put pressure on them in order to block your way of negotiations. What's your take on that?
Well, let's leave aside the Israelis, who from top to bottom have a superiority complex. That's a psychological problem that all Israel, and it's from Netanyahu down to conscripts and volunteers, have. They have a superiority complex, and they're in at present thinking that having decapitated Hezbollah and having destroyed Gaza, they can expand merrily towards the suburbs of Damascus, and that leaves virtually no Arab resistance until they reach Iran. And Iran's the only resistance now, they would think, and therefore they think they're superior and capable of announcing they're about to attack. I don't take that seriously. What I take seriously is what Ray spelled out as the U.S. position. The U.S. position is to lock the Iranians into an impossible decision-making tree. On the one hand, maximal pressure, which motivates the development of mutual assured destruction, the capability to fire missiles that cannot be destroyed by US or Israeli bombing or combination thereof at Israel over a period of time which Israel cannot survive if long enough. I mean, instead, you just look at the situation. With or without a nuclear weapon, Iran instructed Hezbollah not to attack Israeli offshore gas platforms and the supply of gas for their electricity production, not to attack any element of their electricity generation onshore. Who's ever heard of such a restraint? It's not the restraint you see in the war between the United States and Russia on the Ukrainian battlefield. Israel couldn't possibly survive for long, and the Israeli generals admit it. a level of high precision attack on their electricity generating and gas production capacity. If without nuclear weapons, Iran has the capability to strike properly, as Hezbollah was not allowed to strike at Israel's underlying power capacity, then all of the warnings that Israeli generals have been giving that the country cannot survive a sustained attack of that kind would come into play. So all Iran has to do is to preserve its capacities safe from all of the so-called maximal pressure. Second, nobody wants to contradict Donald Trump when he's threatening. And in any event, look at the way in which this administration is running. I've just looked up how many intelligence briefings President Trump gets. He's had two in the month of March. Two. The man does not get intelligence briefings. I don't know what he gets in the morning, possibly certainly some cosmetic improvements and some tanning lotions, but he doesn't get intelligence. He doesn't see what is happening from the point of view of the honest intelligence manager that Ray's just spelled out. If he doesn't see it, and he's given some Walt Disney version of what's happening in the world, and take a look at his daily schedule, he doesn't appear to have a daily schedule in the mornings. It's amazing. He's had more lunches with Vice President Vance than he's had intelligence briefings over the last 2 months. This is the way this gentleman is making decisions. Then you correlate his absence, let's call it thinking about what's happening from the intelligence briefing point of view each day, to his tweet production. You have a disconnect between what he says he's about to do and what he must be thinking for his options. From a point of view of the national interest, and from the point of view of the allies, and from the point of view of the consequences. So who in their right minds in any government outside the United States want to interfere with this level of disconnect between thinking and acting, and between predictability and unpredictability? Everybody then has to say, and Russia's no different from the rest, except Russia's a target. Better you have the ability to exploit the unpredictability. And let's see what he does to attempt to do with Iran, having been warned off in the variety of ways that Ray's just spelled out, and ignore what the Israeli press try to press him to do. Does that answer the question?
I would say that there's one very large Drosophila melanogaster fly in the ointment. Okay, the only thing I remember from biology. Okay.
Wow,
yeah,
that's terrific, right?
Its chromosomes are very close to our own. That's why we use it in lab. Okay, so
yeah,
all right, there's one fly. There's one fly in the ointment, and his name is Benjamin Netanyahu. Okay, now. Who is Trump turning to for advice on Netanyahu and Israel and Israel's feeling of superiority? And why is Trump enabling genocide? Genocide, 2,000-pound bombs. Why does he feel connected in an umbilical cord way to Benjamin Netanyahu? I don't know, okay? I don't understand that at all. I never have. I've watched it for half a century, okay? But it's reality, okay? So Benjamin Netanyahu is in trouble deep, as we used to say in the comic books, okay? His domestic situation is really very fragile, and they're going to get him on this Qatar gate once they get his aides to admit what happened, how much money was put over the table. So he's got every incentive to do what he wants with respect to Iran. The hell with the consequences, because, you know, Trump will always come in. He can always be depended on to bail me out if I get in extremis, okay? And that goes for Iran, too. Now, whoa, that is very labile, as the Germans say. That is very tentative, very dangerous, because if Trump is being guided by this crowd, and they're all Zionists, for God's sake, he's got no break on him. He's not going to listen to Tulsi Gabbard, even if she had the guts to speak out and say what she really knows on this. So it's different from Iran. I mean, it's different from Ukraine. Ukraine is making all the decisions. These other people are sort of, you know, just so, oh, this Mr. Trump said this, POTUS said this. But on Iran and Israel, you know, let's face it. Why did the U.S. do what it did in attacking Iraq in a clear war of aggression, the supreme international crime, by the way, in 2003? Well, immediately after that, I testified in Congress. There are three reasons. I use an acronym, OIL. And they said, no, I can't have that kind of acronym. Oh, yeah, O for oil, I for Israel. And all these Democratic representatives, oh, my God, you can't say that. Okay, yeah. I looked, I said, well, yeah, Israel. I thought to myself, hey, I'm on C-SPAN. I'm on CNN. I'm an intelligence analyst. I can say what I want. I don't need any money. I don't need any promotion. And so they came after me big time. And even John Conyers, the chair of that committee, had to apologize the next day for what McGovern said about Israeli motivation for the attack on Iraq. The other thing, OL, was logistics, the permanent military bases that we coveted in Iraq. Okay, but Israel was the big factor. And as gradually over the years, that was 22 years ago, Israel was the main factor. I had sort of attributed about proportional one third to OIL. No, it was the Israelis crawling all over the Pentagon. It was the Israelis. Some of my colleagues saw this, bending the information. And that's in addition to what Cheney wanted to do anyway, was enough to do it. This time it's different. The Israelis are the same, but we have somebody who keeps reiterating the real trigger here. The trigger would be, Iran is 2 or 3 months away from a nuclear weapon. Well, the intelligence community is standing firm. If Trump wants to, he can resist Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's like, put away that placard that shows that the enrichment is up to 90%. Put it away. They don't have a weapon, okay? So we're not going to bail you out if you take off after Iran. Just be assured that we're not going to do it this time, all right? Now, hopefully they'll do that, but unpredictability being what it is, I can't guarantee that he won't let himself get sucked in because of all this damn advice he gets from Zionists and proto-Zionists within his own administration, not to mention Netanyahu himself.
The only thing I can add to that, and I entirely agree with Ray's analysis, and OIL is a good acronym to apply to almost all decision making in Washington that doesn't involve Germany and France, let's say, the calculation was that Saddam was vulnerable in a way that I do not believe any assessment of Iran plus Russian assistance on air defense. You can't come to the same conclusion that Iran is as vulnerable to being defeated as Saddam was. And that leads to a second line of assessment. What's the risk of a B-2 being shot out of the sky? First, you only need one, and the pilots don't have to die. Just one B-2 down by an Iranian air defense battery assisted by the Russians would be an extraordinary event. Second, what if two come down? What if there's a significant air defense capability on the one hand that does damage to the incoming? That's US and Israel. And second, what if that doesn't materialize, but the Iranians retaliate effectively against Israel and penetrate to hard targets to a degree that they didn't do in the last round of their missile firing? In mm-hmm. other words, you attack them, but they're capable of retaliating at a level of cost Israel can't bear. So you've got two major risks of damage that no politician, not even Netanyahu with a superiority complex and a worry about going to jail, can tolerate. You can't have, and I don't see that what Donald Trump is indifferent to the damage that would be potentially inflicted. So the uncertainty weighs to the advantage of the defense.
That's right. You know, I'm sorry,
go
John,
on.
I didn't mean. No, I wanted to underscore, that's a really important point. Iran is not Iraq. We keep saying
yes.
that. I mean, what does Iran have, about 90 million people? And all these air defense equipment that the Russians have given them most recently, even some very, very sophisticated fighter bombers, if I'm not mistaken. So there's that, okay? Then there's also the fact that U.S. troops, 3,000 or so are in northern Syria, 3,000 or so still in Iraq, even though they've been invited to get out lots of times. And they're all over the region, well within all these missiles that the Iranians have. So it's very, very different from the situation in 2003 in that key respect. And thanks for bringing it up, John, because now you have a Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, let's recognize that all of them over the last three decades, all of these superior officers bubbled up to the top by saluting smartly and saying, Mr. President, you want to do that? Yeah, of course we can do that. Mr. President, you want to build a dock so that you get supplies into Gaza? Can we do that? Sure we do. The thing floats away in two months because of a totally anticipated storm. Okay. So these are yes men. Okay. Now that was in spades during General Frank and all his subordinates. That, you know, you want to attack Afghanistan? We don't. Wait a second. It's Iraq now. All right. No problem. We'll change the battle plan and we'll need 300,000 troops. Oh, no, not 3,000. Oh, Wolfowitz. Oh, Rumsfeld. We only need 100,000. Okay, all right, yeah, we can. Well, that's on the record now, okay? And what is the JCS telling Trump now? I don't know, but I hope that they're a little bit honest. Having been chastened by this experience one generation ago, I hope they're old enough to have read the history books at least and to be able to say to Trump, look, there's no guarantee that we wouldn't lose a lot of servicemen as well as other assets within the immediate area in minutes if Iran is attacked and they think that we're a part of it. Okay, so just realize that, Mr. Trump. And besides, I learned this morning, the Iranians have a space booster, that could conceivably carry a weapon 4,000 kilometers. That's within range of Diego Garcia. Maybe they could get one or two stealth bombers off. I don't know about the rest of them, okay? Last thing, stealth. Stealth means you can sneak in, right? And no radar signal or anything. Forget about it. If I recall correctly, 2 months ago, when the Israelis tried to put some stealth F-35s in against Iran, there were radar signals that indicated that these stealth people are not so stealthy as the Pentagon has claimed. So even stealth bombers are vulnerable to the latest technology. I don't know what it is, but I do recall distinctly that there was a radar signal that the Iranians intercepted, and we intercepted that, showing that they knew that these very sneaky, stealthy things were in their way. So there's a lot, and I hope that the JCS, coming back to my main point, that they will have learned from Iraq, and they will suffer some consequences if they get us involved in a regional war or a world war. That's the big thing. These generals go back to the defense contractors. They make $1 billion. They don't give a rat's patootie about what they did to so many people getting killed.
Can I put that into some Russian legalese to just remind everybody? The wording of Article 3 in the strategic partnership agreement that Mr. Pezeshkian signed with Mr. Putin in January. Article 3 says, and it's the same Article 3 that was signed 21 years before, Russia agrees with Iran that neither side will assist a third party to attack and will do everything possible to assist in negotiating under the Charter of the United Nations. Now, what the second part looks like is a reference to the right of self-defense. Russia confirms that Iran has the right of self-defense, and that means to defend against a US attacker or an Israeli attacker or an Iraqi attacker or anyone. The right of self-defense is an agreement between the two, and Russia will assist Iran with implementing the right of self-defense. Now, that's not going to be trumpeted by anybody in Moscow or in Tehran in the lead up to this threatened war by Israel and the United States. But if Russia is committed not to assist a third party, and Russia is also committed to assist Iran in self-defense, what does that mean? Well, Ray's just spelled it out. There's a level of damage that's capable of being inflicted by Iran with Russian assistance at self-defense against an incoming attacker. And that means mutual assured destruction against the US attacker, if that's what arrives first, or the Israeli attacker. And at some point, the calculation has to be politically, can the attacker escape a level of destruction and damage that makes the attack worthwhile with a domestic constituency? And I would say, at least for the United States, Mr. Trump cannot calculate he could survive a military damage defeat of the kind Iran's capable of inflicting. So he won't risk it. He'll move on to the next easy target. He'll announce something else. After all, he's announced what a big, huge success the attack on the Houthi leadership has been. And there's evidence for that.
Yeah. No, John, I agree. And you always remind me to bring something else up. I make a little note, and then sometimes I remember. John, you know as well as I that the old Soviets had this expression, the world correlation of forces, okay? Now, it used to be pretty level, first between the Soviet Union and the United States, and then China came in, and we had this triangular relationship, you know, where we're sort of equilateral, you know, each one could destroy the world. Well, now it's become isosceles triangle with the US on the short end of the stick. This needs to be recognized because it's a tectonic shift in the world correlation of force. All it means is the balance of power. But you know, the Russians and the Soviets look at this as saying, well, you know, this is really interesting. Now, today, there's something announced by the Russians. Guess who's going to be the guest of honor at our VE triumphal day? Victory in Europe, 80 years, my God. Xi Jinping is coming, okay? He will be not only in the stand right next to Vladimir Vladimirovich, but he'll be on an official state visit. And Wang Yi is in Moscow. Wang Yi is the foreign minister. He's in Moscow now, okay, or yes. This week, yeah, okay. And so he's preparing all this. So, look, folks, the triangle is really, really isosceles. Whether Trump is smart enough or has enough good advice to realize that he's on the short end of the stick, I don't know. But he is a transactional kind of guy. And he must realize not only these broader aspects, but that the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese navies have conducted exercises recently, every year for the last couple of years, in and around Iran. He must realize that this is really more than just a kind of a charade or a red herring. That's the word I was trying to remember before. I remember the fish show over the, well, that's a red herring, okay? So he's got to realize this sort of stuff. And I'm convinced that I think Trump really would like to be invited on May 9th.
One other person who is likely to be invited and likely to accept is Prime Minister Modi.
That's right.
President Putin will go to Delhi within this month. The dates haven't been fixed or announced yet, but the Indian side has already got the welcome placards up on the streets of Delhi.
That's right. Yeah.
That would mean that we will see Modi on one side of President Putin and Xi on the other side. That's a pretty striking display symbolically.
Next to them, I'm sorry, right next to them, John, will be Fico from Slovakia. Okay. He's gone. And there's lots of other people, some other people from NATO, I'm sure. Okay. Maybe a guy from Hungary, what's his name?
Orban.
Yeah, okay. So this is a real shift. Now, real estate developers are accustomed to looking at real shifts, So maybe, what I was starting to say before, I think Trump would really like to be in Moscow for the 9th of May. I don't think there's much chance he will. But wouldn't that be something? In other words, we were allies then. What about the message to the American people? Wow, it was the Russians that won that damn war. Did you know that, American people? Yeah, that's right. They were fighting the Nazis for 3 years before we landed in Normandy. Yeah, how many casualties? Oh, 27 million. How many casualties? American casualties? 400,000. Wow. Just a little vignette. I was in Moscow about 8-9 years ago. We had a little celebration of the meeting on the Elbe, where the Russian forces and the American forces finally came together in April of 1945. They let me make a little speech and recite a little poem. But then a big general in Soviet uniform, 6'4", right, comes up to me after I do this little poem. And I didn't know what to expect. He says, Господин Миклон. Yeah, he says, Studebaker. 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 And he gives me this great big Russian bear hug. What was that all about? Well, most listeners probably don't know that Studebaker Auto Works turned over all their factories in Michigan and elsewhere to the making of two and a half ton trucks. And trucks to pull artillery, and it was a key element in enabling the Russians to prevail against the German hordes, the Nazi hordes. And here was this one infantry general coming up to me, and all he knew in English was the brand name for this automobile, or I think these trucks, Studebaker, and then the big bear hug. There's lots of bear hugs left, okay? The Russians are appreciative. Whether they could have won the war all by themselves, it would take them a lot longer for sure, okay? So why don't we take advantage of this one opportunity to celebrate? After 80 years, we can do it again, because as John Kennedy said before they killed him, the Russians and the Americans are among the only major powers in the world that have not been involved in a major war, one with the other. Now, the caveat there, of course, is we did invade Murmansk and Arkhangelsk, and we put troops in the Far East as well to defeat the Russian Revolution, but that wasn't a major war. Kennedy was right. When the chips were down, we cooperated in meeting the Nazi menace. We helped them succeed, and we should be able to celebrate that, because the Russians are not any real threat to us. If they were, then it would make sense. Some of these Europeans are saying they're just trying to build up their factories and they're trying to get out of recession or depression or worse. They build up their economy. So I'm sorry, John, I'm talking too long here. Did you want to break in?
No. Let Nima.
John, it seems that Russia is not interested in the proposal that the Trump administration is putting forward. And what is in this proposal? What is it? Because they're talking about the roots of the problems in Ukraine are not addressed in this proposal. What are the biggest issues that Russia is concerned of in terms of the Trump administration is not capable of even talking about them?
Well, we've had a whole lot of nothing since the expert group meeting. And that we've had a whole lot of unprecedented openness on the part of the Russian side to say, this is what we tabled. On the expert side of the conversation about the so-called Black Sea Initiative. And the Russians have spelled out point by point, we can go through that in a minute. Second, the Russian side has tabled exactly what it agreed to as the so-called energy infrastructure ceasefire for 30 days. No hits on nuclear plants, no hits on oil and gas pumping stations and refineries and what have you. There's a whole no hits on hydroelectric dams and power generating plants, no hits on electricity distribution grids and the like. Okay, and Russia has stuck to that ceasefire while the Ukrainians, with so-called French assistance and US assistance, has hit at the Sudja gas pumping station, has hit at, attempted to hit the Saratov oil refinery. I can go through all the list of all the attacks attempted by the Ukrainian side since the ceasefire was accepted and implemented on the Russian side. So you have two sets of agreements, one assisted by the used car real estate dealer, Mr. Vitkov, and the second by Peak, and I've forgotten the second US expert who was at in the second round of talks. We've had a very clear set. Sorry?
Mike Waltz? Or?
No. The second set of experts had Peak, and his name's out of. He's the head of the State Department's...
Marco Rubio.
No. The State Department? Yeah. The two experts are one from the NSC and one from the State Department's planning department. I'm sorry, I've got the names in the Dances with Bears, and I can only remember Peak's name.
Doesn't matter.
The important thing is they've said nothing. Second, Trump's tweeting has proposed and claimed advancing the so-called Black Sea Initiative. The Russian side has said, we agree there shouldn't be attacks on vessels that are being used for military purposes. Well, that means the Ukrainians using wheat carriers to launch submarine drones and naval drones against Russian installations and Turkish installations delivering gas to Europe. Second, the Russian side has said we're in favor of what we were in favor of before, the free trade of wheat and fertilizer and the wherewithal in insurance, ports and shipping and payment systems and banking systems to facilitate the food trade. All of that was part of the initial so-called UN Black Sea Initiative mediated by President Erdogan of Turkey. And all of it was violated. And the Russians put up with the violations, for if I'm not mistaken, I wrote about it, the UN tolerated the violations for 2 years. Okay. And then the Russians said, enough, enough. So now the Russian side is saying, and told the expert group in Saudi Arabia, we're ready to go back to that. Just fix it with the other side. There's been no achievement on the US side of Ukrainian agreement to this, to the second, let's call it the Black Sea Maritime Agreement terms, none whatever. Instead, there's been a lot of noise from the British, the French, the Anglo-American media saying that really Russia's just trying to break the sanctions on SWIFT. That's right. SWIFT has to be, the payment system has to be restored in order to make food payments and shipping payments and insurance payments. It's very clear what the Russian side said. First, lift the sanctions on the food trade, then we will agree to resume the food trade. So,
the Europeans have refused cold turkey, so to speak. They refused to do that.
So we have no result.
Now, the other one about not bombing energy facilities, that was really weird also. I've never seen such a messy kind of negotiation. You don't know when it starts. You don't know when the deadline or for the ceasefire starts. You don't really know what it is. Well, they did specify, look, the one against energy facilities, that starts when we talk. That is Putin and Trump on the 18th of March. Okay, so that expires in 30 days. Okay, at least they have that date certain. The Ukrainians are violating that every day. And, so that's not going to fly either. What we have here is a situation where the Europeans are not only being unhelpful, they are being disruptive, and they're putting the kibosh on any agreement, for example, on the Black Sea Initiative, even though the Russians aren't really hurting. Commerce is completely okay. The Russians are quite able to intercept major arms deliveries, or if not intercept them, they wait till they get on the wharf and then do them in, okay? So there's no particular urgency to that. It's just that Trump thought, oh, maybe this is something that the Russians could buy into. And they did. And then the Europeans said, forget about it. What's the bottom line here? It seems to me that Europe faced all this after the Soviet Union fell apart. And even before the Helsinki agreements, the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, issued forth with many agreements and even some structures. One of those structures was to monitor the ceasefire that never really went into effect in the Donbas between Ukrainian troops and the Donetsk and Luhansk troops, okay? Now, people don't know this because it's not been in the mainstream media, but in the middle of February 2022, okay, so a week or about 10 days before the special military operation, the amount of shelling of Ukrainian cities in Donbas, that is Donetsk and Luhansk, went up by a factor of 10. How do I know that? The conference the Security and Cooperation in Europe monitors on the scene reported it. And it was in there. I have the graph showing this. It looks like this, 500 attacks a day, whatever, 12,000, I think it was, okay? So that was like February 16th, I believe is the right date. Now, nobody knows that, but that's the work of the Conference on European Security and Cooperation. And why didn't they make a big thing out of that? Because they're paid and they're in the pocket of the West. They didn't say diddly about it. They did put out the graph. I still have it and I could show it to you. What does that mean? What does it mean? That it means that this security arrangement was based on the need for no country to take unfair advantage, to try to increase its own security at the expense of others. That was concretized in many agreements, okay? So what we have here, is a mutual security thing that just won't it just won't quit. And bottom line, again, is that there is no security without mutual security. As long as the Russians feel threatened by Ukraine on its border, part of NATO, not going to happen, but how can they assure that? They got to pursue this advance to the West as far as they need to, okay? So no security without mutual security. It's sort of like a highfalutin way of saying the golden rule, okay? It's you don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you on a national scale. And once Trump realizes, and he should be able to, he's capable of realizing this kind of thing, that the Russians just pretty much want to be secure. They feel betrayed. And I'll raise one more time, when Putin called Biden on the 30th of December, 2021, okay, so what, 2 months before the invasion, he said, look, my military are really after me. They want personal assurance from you that you will not put hypersonic missiles in Ukraine. You told your military that you would do that. Now, if I could tell my negotiators that you said, well, we're not going to do that, this would get our negotiations in Geneva right off the bat really good, and it would satisfy fully four or five of the provisions that we have in that draft treaty that we gave you in NATO. What do you say? Biden, home alone during Christmas time, without Sullivan, without Blink, said, sounds like a good idea to me. The readout, the President of the United States said, we have no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. What happened? They reneged on that. Tony Blinken told Lavrov, come on, give me a break. Forget about that. We were with the president then. He was in Delaware, for God's sake. Forget about it. We have every right to put those. So there's a microcosm of how the Russians are looking. We were betrayed many times. Minsk and the whole, you know, back in when Jim Baker promised not to expand. So we have a whole history of this. So what surprises me, Nima and John, is that even so, even as Putin admits candidly, people want me to go faster against the Ukrainian troops that are left in Ukraine. They're wondering why I'm going so slowly and deliberately, okay? Even that, Putin says to these submariners 5 days ago in Murmansk, he says, you know, in my opinion, the President of the United States really does, is very sincere in wanting a peaceful relationship with us and will work together with us on Ukraine. He said that twice. And each time he said, in my opinion. So he's way out on a limb here, as is Trump. And to the degree that Putin fears the military or the hardliners who want him to go faster, who want him never to accept that an American president could be sincere, you know, or that he wouldn't lie, cheat, and steal. Well, that's a good thing. And that gives me hope that if Trump is really hell-bent on getting rid of Ukraine, and if, as I suspect strongly, Putin is telling him, look, you go into Iran, or you let yourself be mousetrapped by Bibi Netanyahu into doing that, forget about the whole damn thing. We're going to have a big celebration with China. That will be a graphic representation of the change in the balance of power. You can do your own thing. We will adequately protect ourselves and say goodbye to Ukraine. And we're not going to make it easy for you. We're going to wipe your face in it, because we've had it with the Ukrainians and we've had it with you, Mr. Trump. I don't think Trump wants that to happen.
John, just we were going to talk about JFK and the case of JFK. And it's so amazing to know how does Russia feel about that and what's their sort of view on that.
Well, 2 points. First of all, I appreciate all that Ray has been publishing and podcasting on what the meaning is of the so-called new evidence confirming the old evidence of who was behind the murder of John F. Kennedy and who was behind the cover-up. I can just pass over to raise accounts of that, because I have nothing more to add. He's done all the work, and the people he's referred to have done all the work. The interesting thing is that there's been virtually no Russian commentary on these disclosures. So in the absence of any comment other than reporting that the papers have been released, there's been no analysis of whether there's anything new from a Russian point of view. Well, the answer is, the silence means there is nothing new in the disclosure to Russians or the Soviets that this is what the CIA does in countries, including the United States. So Russian silence means that, as Ray's explained with the evidence, the disclosure that the CIA was involved in the plot to kill and then deeply involved in the plot to cover up. So from a Russian point of view, the answer is, the response is, so what? We already knew that. We mm-hmm. suffer from it.
Yes, John, thank you for that. Nima, may I reply?
Go ahead, Ray, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I would just say that that's exactly how the Russians pieced it together from the outset. And let's remember that John F. Kennedy was hell-bent on creating a decent relationship with Russia. As I said before, he uniquely pointed out that Russia and America had never been in a major war alone among the major powers, okay? He reached out 5 months before he was assassinated, saying, look, we have a lot in common. We know that you suffered greatly in World War II, 20 million people dead. Well, that was off by 7 million. It was 27 million, but at least he was reaching out. Now, that was verboten for people who thought that the Russians were the evil incarnate. So, is there any parallel to today? Is anybody reaching out to the Russians and saying, look, we can work deals in Ukraine and elsewhere? Oh, I suppose there is. Yeah, his name is Donald Trump. So, what's new? Well, Donald Trump is in possession not only of material showing what happened to John F. Kennedy, and he has released it. There have been a couple of nuggets there which were revealed in the testimony yesterday, namely that three top CIA officials are proven now to have lied under oath about Oswald, that James Angleton, the eminence grise, had a folder about 200 pages on Oswald on his desk when JFK was assassinated. Oh, and they said they didn't know anything about Oswald, right? So there are lots of little nuggets coming out. But as far as the Russians are concerned, you know, this is just speculation, but I've watched the Russians for a long time. And I think that if I were giving Putin his PDB, you know, his president's daily brief, as I did to Reagan for 4 years, I would say, Mr. Putin, Donald Trump has done something that is really, really dangerous to him. You should know about it. Not only the JFK papers, but the papers showing that the deep state, CIA, FBI, Department of Justice, for God's sake, all these people were plotting against him, first, not to let him become elected, and then secondly, to put the kibosh on any plan he had to have a decent relationship with you. Sound familiar? I think that's what JFK was trying to do. So all I try to say, we PDBers to you, Mr. Putin, is that Trump is vulnerable to the same people who are still around and who have a hell of a lot more to lose this time, because it's all on paper. The Comeys, the Brennans, the others that are named and shown to have violated the law, Willie Linney, because they were convinced that Hillary Clinton would win, right? Okay, That's out there now. What are they going to do? Well, we can't be sure that Trump's going to be around for much longer. So what we would suggest to you, Mr. Putin, is to bear that in mind, because to the degree that Trump really wants to get Ukraine behind him to go off and do China, for God's sake, or Middle East, to the degree he wants to settle on Ukraine, he may not have much time left. We say that advisedly. It happened before. He already escaped one shot, right? We'll look at his earlobe, all right? So we don't have to be conspiracy theorists. We Russian analysts. we just want to tell you, that's the new lay of the land. The information is being disclosed despite all the attempts of the mainstream media to keep it suppressed. We have people like this Nima folk, the guy from Brazil, and McGovern and Helmer mouthing these things off. The people are going to learn about this, and it's going to be trouble. So be aware, Mr. Putin, that there's a time horizon here that you should plan against. And if that requires some concessions from you, let's say on Odessa or Kharkiv, there's leeway there. You've won the war. You let Trump down easy and get this agreement before he's no longer around. That's speculative, but I think if I were in the KGB successors, I'd be telling Putin precisely that. And that may be one reason why Trump himself has a certain kind of urgency that is really hard to explain in getting all this behind him on Ukraine.
Can I add a couple of personal things that might resonate with the non-American audience listening to us? It's one thing to uncover what the CIA's misdeeds have been in the past. It's a second thing to ensure they don't keep doing it. And in that sense, Ray's right, it's possible that President Trump will see the CIA as a threatening to his life or continuation as President of the United States, as John F. Kennedy failed to understand. But for the non-Americans who understood, the Greeks who understood the amount of effort the CIA has played to overthrow one government after another in Greece, including the predecessors of the present government in Greece. But let me tell you, this has happened in my family. In my family, my mother's brother, a man called Zelman Cowan, was the head of state in Australia, and he was put there by the CIA. That's not a story that anyone dares to print in Australia. What happened? Well, go back to the story that Jimmy Carter sent Warren Christopher, the Deputy Secretary of State, to Australia to promise that the CIA would never try to overthrow an Australian government again after the Christopher and the Carter administration admitted that the CIA had helped to overthrow Gough Whitlam's Labor government in 1975. The promise that they wouldn't do that again was broken. And it was broken by a process which put the CIA and State Department selection for the Governor General in power. Why do I know? Because it happened that Zelman Cowan is not only a relative of mine, but I knew and have yet to write the book about it, and have been suing in DC federal court for several years to get the US documents on it, that Zelman Cowan betrayed Australia, betrayed Australian politicians, students, professors, everybody. He was very talkative to the CIA, very talkative to the FBI, and very talkative to the State Department. And those documents have been withheld in federal court for my lawsuit for nearly 10 years. But it don't take my word for it. A former Prime Minister of Australia who benefited from the coup that overthrew Gough Whitlam. An Australian audience knows all about this. I'm simply saying it as an example of what continues to threaten countries around the world and regimes around the world. Malcolm Fraser won power because Gough Whitlam was overthrown in circumstances we don't need to go into now. Long after Malcolm Fraser had ceased to exercise power, one semi-drunken afternoon in his retirement, he told me he never knew Zelman Cowan and didn't appoint him Governor General. That's to say, the Prime Minister of a country didn't appoint the President or Head of State of a country. Where then did the appointment come from? The US Embassy, Fraser said, and I can say it because Fraser told me he couldn't be quoted, and he's dead now. Zelman Cowan's dead now. My mother, who told me never to tell this story, is dead now. Everybody's dead now. So I can begin to tell the story, but I didn't want to tell the story until I had the documents from the FOIA litigation that I've run for 10 years. And all that I can get out of the courts of the United States in DC, and all I can get out of state and CIA, is a list of the menus that the Governor General turned on when President Bush visited Australia. In other words, the documents are deep sixed. If President Trump was serious about stopping the CIA threatening him, it would be very valuable that he exposed the extent to which the deep state threatens all of these states, especially US allies like Australia. But in my particular case, I know what happened. I know independently of what happened, independently of my own family. And it's a story that's never been told and can't be told in Australia. Why? Because it's too busy of those officials who've been recruited over all these years to be loyal to the United States. Don't dare tell this story. Now, if Trump were to open the files, then it wouldn't just reverberate in Australia, it would reverberate right around the world. And that's the significance, as I see it, of the JFK disclosures. It's not new as a theory. It's not new as a series of facts, the killing, the plotting, and then the cover-up, but that it that sequence applies all around the world, especially to those allies of the United States.
Wow. Now, John, will the mainstream media explain this as you have so artfully done?
No.
In Australia?
No. Of course not.
So, Nima, make sure that this gets to all your Australian colleagues. This is you know, Gough Whitlam, I knew about all that, but the fact that nobody else knows about it is really criminal. So that's the sticky wicket. Thanks so much, Nima, for allowing this kind of conversation. Let's hope that some people are listening. And not only that, we'll try to do something about this mess.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John and Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you both.
Take care.